During his regular days in London, Kenneth Graham sat behind a mahogany desk as Secretary of the Bank of England. On weekends, he retired to the house in the country that he shared with his wife, Elspeth, and their fragile son, Alistair. The results of these pastoral wanderings was The Wind in the Willows, an enduring classic of children's literature, a cautionary tale for adult readers, a warning of the fragility of the English countryside, and an expression of fear of threatened social changes that, in the aftermath of World War I, became a reality. Matthew Dennison, who has written about Beatrix Potter, among others, is the author of the new book, The Man in the Willows, The Life of Kenneth Graham. The book is published by Pegasus, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Matthew Dennison to the roundtable this morning. Matthew, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
What brought you to The Life of Kenneth Graham?
I had written a book about Beatrix Potter a couple of years earlier, and I was interested generally in what we tend to call Golden Age British children's fiction, fiction written between about 1870 and 1930. Kenneth Graham is an almost exact contemporary of Beatrix Potter, and both writers suffered the same emotional deprivation in childhood. They were both members of mid-Victorian generation, which in theory is the most confident generation of Britons ever born. And they were both people who were born to backgrounds of some material prosperity. So I wanted to look at how that generation of person confronting emotional deprivation entered into imaginative escape and turned that imaginative escape into something creative which has lasted for an immensely long time.
And that escape is such a natural escape, such a connection to the outdoors.
Yes. What, of course, is not natural is to turn that very personal response and those personal experiences into some sort of literary form which is then shared universally.
But again, it's something that both Graham did and something both also Beatrix Potter did. Give us a sense of the upbringing of Kenneth Graham and the childhood that he had.
Graham had an extraordinarily peripatetic childhood, so he was continually on the move. This was brought about really by a series of family tragedies. So his mother dies when he's only five. Between Kenneth's birth and the moment of his mother's death, they had left Edinburgh, the capital of Scotland, the town in which he was born, because his father's alcoholism was beginning to cause scandal at the Scottish bar. And so they'd retreated to the west coast of Scotland, which at that point would have been a fairly remote sort of place. What this does mean was that as a very small child, Kenneth was brought into contact with immensely beautiful, still unspoilt landscape, the wonderful landscape of Argyllshire, Loch Fyne and its surrounds. After Kenneth's mother's death, his father's alcoholism escalates very dramatically, and Graham Pear is simply unable to help himself. And so the children are whisked away to a maternal grandmother in Berkshire in southeast England. So it's a journey of 500 miles. It's an entirely different landscape. It's really an entirely different outlook on life at this point. Kenneth's grandmother appears to have been a rather cold woman. Having said that, as a woman in her early 60s with very little domestic help at the time, she really wasn't best placed to look after a family of four very young children. And so it's in this moment of first expulsion from Scotland, from a kind of personal Eden, at a house called The Mount, where Kenneth lives with his siblings and grandmother, just for 2 years between the age of five and seven, that he makes this real emotional connection with nature, because he retreats from the coldness and the sort of numbing unhappiness of great bereavement into an imaginary world, playing in the large garden of this house that is perched not so far away from the Thames. Unfortunately, Mrs. Inglis didn't have a frightful lot of money, and so when the chimney stack collapsed on this house in a terrible storm in December 1865, she had to move. And from that point onwards, Kenneth's childhood, he's always moving the houses that Mrs. Inglis rents, then off to boarding school at the age of nine in Oxford, which he really hated, and then pulled out of boarding school early in order to go and work in London, although what he'd really hoped for had been time at the university in Oxford. So it's a series of events in his life that drag him out of one environment into another environment. Just as he becomes comfortable in the next environment, he tends to be pulled out of it.
You do say that he was a quiet child, and imaginative escape molded Kenneth Graham's childhood. And that escape is something that he found expression, he would scribble in books and he would play games, and he was a quiet kid but had a lot going on in his head.
And that becomes a lifelong habit for him. So for the remainder of his life, Graham is somebody who retreats within himself into an immensely rich imaginary world. And on the surface, his is a life marked by considerable unhappiness, and it's possible to posit Graham as a deeply unhappy man. But my feeling is he was somebody who throughout his life found happiness, but very much on his own, in his own head.
You write in the book, and you mentioned this a moment ago, but the Mount is a place of great love for him. He is able to have that get away from reality at that place.
Yes, and he learns this habit that initially is not conscious of attachment to landscape. I think the three older Graham siblings are all too young really to help one another. So you think, well, gosh, he's one of four children. Perhaps they could have supported one another. But really, they're too small to do that. So all of these children are separately wrestling with bereavement of their mother, but also being separated from their father and this rather cold grandmother. And in Graham's case, he just finds the emotional nourishment that he needs in this extraordinarily beautiful garden. It seems to have been a classic sort of 19th century garden that included bits of highly manicured, tortured nature, but also passages that were much more natural. And there was a wood and there was a lake and, of course, a distant view of the Thames. And the Thames at that point in Berkshire is rather slow and sluggish and green and overhung by trees. So in a way, very appealing and very unthreatening. He chooses, it seems to me, for the rest of his life to cling to this vision of the Mount. And even in his 40s, he says to an American journalist that he can remember every detail of himself and that place as if it were yesterday, and he can remember it with astonishing crispness. And indeed, the essays he writes seems to suggest he can, but of course it could be a fabrication because he wants to hold on to that vision of something that was nurturing and sustaining.
Matthew Dennison is our guest. He is the author of the new book, The Man in the Willows, The Life of Kenneth Graham. When does he start actively writing and become serious in that craft?
In his 20s. So one of his uncles decides that he will go and work in the Bank of England. Bank of England in the 19th century is not as much concerned with commerce as we tend to assume that banks are nowadays. And it's a rather hooliganish place. And Kenneth Graham enjoys the Dickensian picturesqueness of the Bank of England, which at that point is already acknowledged as a very venerable British institution. But he doesn't feel that he fits with the other people there. And he cherishes a desire to write, which his family have done their very best to stamp on. He begins writing a series of short newspaper articles, not articles about news, but light essays in the manner of Robert Louis Stevenson. They gain him a small following, and then in his sort of late 20s into his 30s, he seems to segue, for reasons that we don't really understand, into short stories about a family like his own, but in the fictional case of five children rather than four children, and he reimagines those years at the Mount in a series of short stories.
When he, in adulthood, the path for him and his career, he decides to do what?
Well, it's interesting because having been sent to the Bank of England, presumably very much against his wishes, because he'd hoped to go to university in Oxford, then he'd hoped to write, he doesn't leave the Bank of England. He stays there for more than 30 years. He becomes third in charge. He becomes a very senior bank official and has on the surface, a very successful banking career. But this, to me, absolutely fits with the way that Graham goes through his life. So he lives, in fact, a pair of parallel lives. So he lives a sort of Monday to Friday London life as a banking figure, at all moments outside those working hours, he is lost in his own imaginative world, or he's walking outside London, just absorbing landscape, engaging with landscape. He talks about lying down on hilltops and feeling that he's just becoming part of nature. And then he begins to write more and more. He never writes a great deal. He always describes himself as a tap and not a spring. He describes the process of writing as deeply painful. He never wants to become a full-time writer, which could be, I think, a sort of 19th century snobbery that a gentleman doesn't earn his living by writing. So he writes the short stories about the children. They're published in two volumes. They're very successful commercially. He's lionized up to a point. Then he writes The Wind in the Willows after an interval, and then he doesn't ever write again.
You talk about his marriage, and you say that they were, he and his wife, Elspeth, they were unsuccessful partners and unsuccessful lovers. They would become unsuccessful parents.
Mm. Really, they're entirely unsuited to be with one another. Having said that, if we were to put them together on a modern dating app, we would think, well, hey, we've got a match here. They were both child adults, or adult child, however you like to look at it. They both had an extraordinary fantasy life. They both clung on to a vision of their own childhood. They both were enthralled to really the glamour of a kind of literary life. But they were both people who, particularly in Graham's case, were incapable of feeling much emotional empathy with another person. Graham grew up to become, to my mind, an absolutely natural bachelor because he couldn't really deal with anybody else's emotions beyond his own. A marriage that began with a rather quirky courtship, but there certainly were positive moments in it, and moments of real excitement, and I think also moments of powerful physical attraction, quickly goes badly wrong, and we have two unhappy people living at separate ends of the same house.
So Alistair Graham comes into the picture May 12th, 1900, and as you write, they start calling the child Mouse. And it is this time, and again, you make the connection to Beatrix Potter and the Tale of Peter Rabbit, that the story of A Wind in the Willows, The Wind in the Willows, begins orally.
Yes. Elspeth Graham appears to fall pregnant on the couple's honeymoon, at which point I think probably their physical life ended, and really any real intimacy ended with it. Happily, she does fall pregnant. She has this baby. It's very obvious from the moment that Mouse is born that something is not quite right. He's blind in one eye. He has a terrible squint in another eye. He's slow to develop physically. He seems to be slow to develop verbally, for example. But both parents choose to regard him as a prodigy. And it's as if they channel all of their deep frustrations at their own relationship into their imagining of the child. The child has to be perfect in order to paper over the cracks in their own relationship, albeit they parent separately, really. Like most prosperous 19th century parents, they spend a lot of time apart from the child. The child is with nursemaids and governesses, etc., etc., etc. Having said that, Graham begins to tell stories to the little boy when the little boy is only about three. And the stories that he tells him are the toad stories at the heart of The Wind in the Willows. So The Wind in the Willows is really two books. It's a series of adventures of Toad, which Graham had originally made up to tell his son, firstly orally when they were walking or at bedtime, and later in a series of letters, much as Beatrix Potter wrote The Tale of Peter Rabbit. And then it's another story about riverbankers, and particularly Mole and Mole's attachment to home and a feeling of connectedness to place.
You say about The Wind in the Willows that it is an aggressively conservative book and its targets include socialism and any form of faddishness or craving for novelty, Toad's weakness. The book has very much a reflection of Graham and his thoughts and his dark thoughts, quite frankly.
Yes, very early on in his life, when he's really quite young, Graham becomes somebody who fears what we might term progress in the sense of modern developments, particularly any kind of physical development of the landscape, railways, roads, that sort of thing. And This novel that's first published in 1908, it is an extraordinarily nostalgic book, even for the time. Now, there are significant social changes in Britain in the aftermath of the First World War. Here we have a book written only 6 years before the outbreak of war, which posits a kind of idealized rural society, but idealized in terms of the people who are on top. So it's a book that idealizes a kind of squirearchical or aristocratic existence, if you like, with Toad at the apex, living at Toad Hall, and then everybody else acknowledging their position and not trying to break free from it. Of course, this wasn't really what was happening in Britain at the time, because there'd been agricultural depression since the late 19th century, which had significantly dented British landowners' fortunes. That was why so many British aristocrats married American heiresses in this period, and also the introduction of death duties, which had further diminished British landed fortunes.
The book gets published, and give us a sense of its success, of how it comes out of the box.
Oh, poor Kenneth. It's a disaster. So this book, in which he had invested so much of himself, is rejected by his own publisher of 20 years and by just about every other publisher there is. Eventually, he strikes a deal with Methuen, who refused to pay him in advance, but he does manage to negotiate rather tough royalties, which stood him in very good stead later on. The book was published, and reviews were more than mixed. There was an overwhelming consensus that this really was not a good or an enjoyable book, partly, I think, because people overwhelmingly missed the point of it. So, amusingly, the Times Literary Supplement, which is really Britain's most authoritative literary journal, claims that it's a very poor contribution to natural history, which is a bit like saying that the geology of The Hobbit isn't up to much. And there's a failure to understand really what Kenneth is trying to do. I think some people didn't know if it was meant to be a children's book or not. I'm not sure that Graham himself knew if it was meant to be a children's book or not. And certainly he didn't primarily intend it as a children's book. So it got off to a very bumpy start, and then it became a slow burner. And within a handful of years, it was an established hit. Even Theodore Roosevelt, who had been a great fan of Graham's earlier short stories, had at first written to him saying that he was disappointed by The Wind in the Willows, but on rereading had got the point of it and grown to love it. And I think that seems to be what happened.
There were calls for a sequel. People wanted him to write more about these characters, and that was something he knew he did not want to do.
Because there was no need for him to do that. It had been an act of self-communing, it seems to me, up to a point, writing this book. And he had expressed his vision of the way he wanted things to be. And that book says everything that Graham needed it to say. It celebrates the beauties of a particular English kind of landscape. It celebrates the joys of home and homecoming. It celebrates bachelor camaraderie, which was an important part of his life that had been sort of stolen from him by marriage. It celebrates this rural hierarchy in which he invested such belief. It celebrates a kind of pantheism which for him had replaced ordinary Christian orthodoxies. It has a degree of love between parents and children, and it excludes female spouses. So every box that Graham would want to tick had been ticked by this book. Why would he possibly write a sequel?
We're talking about the life of Kenneth Graham. Matthew Dennison's book is The Man in the Willows. It is published by Pegasus Books. There were also calls for him to write an autobiography, that it was not something he was interested in. And then there is more tragedy that befalls him, which ultimately leaves him in a great depression.
Yes, so Mouse's career really never gets off the ground. And the terrible thing that happens to this little boy is that he is brought up by his parents when young to believe in himself as remarkable, and he becomes a rather bumptious, showing-off sort of child. And, of course, like any other middle-class child of his time in Britain, he's sent off to a boarding prep school where he's quickly made aware of his shortcomings. And the shortcomings are considerable. You know, in British schooling system at that time, really what mattered were games, sport. And he's a hopeless games player, he's a hopeless sportsman. And so, you know, in a British boarding school at this point, you are bottom of the heap as a hopeless sportsman. And he's also not terribly clever. And poor Mouse, his tragedy is to understand very fully his own shortcomings, to recognize the disconnect between what his parents have told him about himself and the reality as other people see it. And the parents remain determined not to recognize this. Kenneth forces Mouse into Oxford, where he himself had so much wanted to go. He gets him in through the back door. Mouse can't pass any of the exams. He keeps failing the exams. And eventually he almost certainly commits suicide. Suddenly he is found dead across railway lines, decapitated with his head cut off. And the coroner takes a generous view and claims that this is an accident, presumably to spare Graham's feelings, because Graham is a famous man by this stage. But it would appear from the position of the body that he had deliberately laid himself across the lines in order to be killed. And Graham, who is such an emotionally costive man and so emotionally bruised and damaged, really, never recovers from this final body blow. And I think at that point, his retreat into a sort of imaginative world of one is completed.
I would like to close with his relationship with Ernest Shepherd. Of course, so many of us grew up with those illustrations, and I'm curious. Of course, Shepherd, well known for his illustrations of A. Milne's Winnie the Pooh. What brings those two men together to have him do the drawings? And the fascinating story that you tell in the book, unlike Milne, who worked with Shepherd and brought him to the Hundred Acre Wood, that really Shepherd was on his own when it came to depicting the riverside that Graham knew.
Yes, so those illustrations are begun 3 years before Graham dies, and Graham himself has no part in the commission. It's instigated by Methuen. There'd been a real problem in illustrating the book, and the first edition wasn't illustrated at all because Graham is inconsistent and he plays games with scale. So there are moments, for example, when these little animals must be nearly life-size, otherwise the plot doesn't work. It's not possible that they could lead a horse pulling a caravan if they were genuinely the size of a toad, for example. Nor could Toad have these encounters with the jailer's daughter if there was such a disparity of scale. Having said that, at other moments in the book, it only works because the mole is mole-sized and can have a conversation with a field mouse on some level of equality. So there were real problems about this. But because the book quickly became established as a children's book, illustrations were felt appropriate. Shepherd was the man to illustrate a very successful book because of the success, as you say, of his Winnie the Pooh illustrations. He meets Graham, who really just says to him, you know, take care, I love these people, be gentle with them, and then lets him get on with it. So Graham, by that stage, is living again in a house close to the Thames, but not the stretch of the Thames that had inspired The Wind in the Willows. And he sends Shepherd out to walk along the riverbanks, to look at things, to absorb things, but really to absorb them in his own way. So it is a fantastic imaginative alchemy that is going on here that produces those wonderful illustrations, which actually have given the book continuing life, because I certainly in Britain it feels as if many children no longer read The Wind in the Willows, that it survives in this country as a book that parents read aloud to their children, and the child's primary engagement is usually through Toad's adventures, but particularly as realized in the pictures.
Do you think that, and I'm wondering about this because I, having finished your book, and now we'll go back to read The Wind in the Willows again, do you look at that work differently, knowing more about the man?
What I hoped when I had finished this book is that what readers would take from my book would illuminate a reading of The Wind in the Willows without in any way spoiling their pleasure in it. And I hope that I succeeded in that. My feeling is that when you go back to the book, The Wind in the Willows is such an intensely luscious book that you are sucked into it and you're very rapidly just absorbed into its world. And a little bit like the Winnie the Pooh stories, it's a book of some profundity. And so actually you can read it at any stage of your life. You can read it all the way through your life at different ages, and you will always draw something wonderful from it. I think it is genuinely a very special and deep and iridescent book that has an enormous amount to offer to us. And I was very careful when writing about Graham not to spoil for people the special experience that reading The Wind in the Willows is.
Matthew Dennison's new book is The Man in the Willows, The Life of Kenneth Graham. It is published by Pegasus Books. Matthew, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the book is The Man in the Willows, The Life of Kenneth Graham. It is by Matthew Dennison and published by Pegasus. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.